MacCast, Sunday, May 15th, 2016. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I hope you are having a great week. It has been an interesting week again in the world of Apple. Lots of stuff happening. Of course, we've got rumors, more rumors of what's happening with iPhone, next generation iPhone. Something going on with HomeKit, or maybe not. We're going to talk about that a little bit. There was a meeting that happened last week with Apple and top podcasters. And as you can imagine, I'm very interested in knowing on, I was very interested in knowing what went on there. So I followed that story pretty closely. I'm going to share my thoughts and opinions on that. We're going to talk a little bit more about iPhone in India and maybe some things that are happening there that could help Apple out a little bit. Also, this past week, we saw the next generation, or almost like I'm calling her the sibling of Siri, Viv. We're going to talk about Viv a little bit. Some more news on Apple Pay expansion into another country. We're going to talk about that and follow up a little bit from last week on Apple Pay in Australia. There's some more news about how Apple Pay is doing down under. And then some rumors about iTunes maybe changing their whole business model. And we'll get into that a little bit. And then Apple increasing R&D spending. And what does that mean? We have all of that. And then a lot of feedback from you this week on a number of the stories that we've been talking about. So we're going to continue our feedback on wireless charging. We're going to talk about the story about the iTunes bug or the Apple Music bug where music was being deleted from a user's account. We're going to follow up on that a little bit because there's a little more news and information that has surfaced since we last spoke. We're going to continue a little bit our discussion about upgrading your Macs and your iOS devices and how frequently you do that, or we do that. And we got a response from Nick. I shared some of his opinions. We had gone back and forth on Twitter. Well, Nick sent in a voice comment for us, so he's going to clarify a little bit his position on the whole thing, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. And a great little tip on restoring files from a place you may not think of. And then a question about package managers. So should be a pretty feature-packed show. We'll get into it here in just a minute. But before I get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. You know, speaking of upgrading your devices and your Apple products, a great way to get some cash to do that is to go to gazelle.com. And it's because Gazelle makes it easy for you to get cash for your old iPhone, your old iPad, your old MacBook. They also take Apple displays and even Apple TVs. And the way it works is you can get a free and easy offer online. All you have to do is answer a few easy questions about what you want to sell, the condition that it's in, what kinds of accessories you have, and then boom, right there on gazelle.com, you will get an instant offer, an instant price quote. And don't worry if you've got a broken phone, Gazelle will accept those too. And you'll see the offer. If you choose to accept it, they're going to honor that for 30 days. So you have 30 days to send that in. And they pay for shipping. And in many cases, they'll even send you a box to send your stuff back in. They make it super simple. I've sold many iPhones back through Gazelle. And I can tell you the experience every time was great. Make it really easy. And all the personal information is removed on your device. You put it in the box. You send it in. They receive it. They check it over, just make sure that everything matches the condition and the parameters of, you know, what you answered. And as long as that happens, you get a fast, quick payment. And you can even choose how you want to get paid. You can get paid by check in the mail, an Amazon gift card, or direct deposit into your PayPal account. It couldn't be easier. And Gazelle has served over 1 million customers. They've paid out over $200 million. And they are the best in the business at this. So you can get cash for that old iPhone, iPad, or Mac today simply by going to gazelle.com right now. And a big thank you to Gazelle for their support of the MacCast. Going to kick off the show today talking about HomeKit. And you know, regardless of what your opinion is on HomeKit, and as you know, listening to this show, I have some of my own opinions. One of the things you often hear talked about is the frustration over there not being sort of a cohesive experience on the software side. And this wouldn't be the first time that we heard this rumor, but there was a rumor that surfaced this week that Apple was going to make their own home application that would control all of your HomeKit devices. Now, Mac Rumors said they discovered this in a review for a smart home devices product on Amazon.com, of all places. And right away, this made me think, oh, this is a little bit weird, because it was supposedly written by an Apple marketing employee. They actually put that right in the statement in the review. And Mac Rumors claimed that it linked back to a LinkedIn profile, and that also they independently confirmed that employee's connection to Apple. Now, I would say it's not clear after this story ran if that employee would still be working at Apple's in Apple's marketing department, because generally Apple kind of frowns on any kind of blogging, any sort of thing like that. But supposedly in the review, they mentioned some third-party apps like the Home application, not the one that Apple is supposedly going to be writing, but there's actually a great app called Home for controlling your all of your HomeKit devices. They mentioned that one. They say the next version of iOS in the fall will also have a standalone HomeKit app as well, sort of implying that Apple was actually working on something. And there's some other rumors in the past that back this up a little bit, because there was a trademark filed by Apple for a HomeKit application icon way back when, and that surfaced, I think, through Mac Rumors as well. And the app is rumored to be called Home, and you might think, well, there's already an app called Home, so how are they going to handle that? Well, Apple, when they bought iWork, or when they brought out iWork way back when, that was actually being used by a company called IG Software, and they simply, I think, bought that name from IG Software. IG changed their product name to iBiz, so it certainly is possible that Apple could bring out an app with exactly that same name. But as you might have already gathered by how I'm kind of covering this story, here's the punchline. And most sites who covered this story, you know, they covered the big headline, Apple's working on their own HomeKit app. They heard the same background story, but they didn't follow up when Mac Rumors later learned that the entire thing was a hoax. Somebody had posted a hoax review on Amazon.com, probably trying to see which of us in the media would actually pick it up. So Mac Rumors, for their part, they did update their article, but of course, many other outlets don't update their article as well. But I think the story's more interesting and was more believable because it really feeds on a pretty deep emotion from a lot of HomeKit users, myself included, that it hasn't really lived up to a lot of the promises that it had when Apple showed it off to us. You know, the whole idea was it was supposed to make home automation completely plug and play simple, and it just really hasn't done that. Although I think a lot of the problem doesn't fall so much on the software for me as much as it does on the hardware, because there are already some great third-party apps that solve the software side of this thing. I think where it really falls short is I think Apple needs to bring out some kind of HomeKit server or hub. It'd be great if it was built into maybe the airport router, or even better yet, into the Apple TV. But my big issue with HomeKit is that when I buy one brand of devices, I get their hub, and I buy another brand of devices and I get their hub, and I have all these different hubs and products from different companies, and they all integrate because they're all HomeKit, but it all feels a little piecemeal. It feels a little kludgy. It's not seamless. So if Apple could handle the centralization of the hub part of it and just let the third-party devices tap into, because they're HomeKit compatible, the centralized hub. And then if Apple wants to write a great app on top of that, a piece of software on top of that to manage all of it, built into iOS and built into the Mac, that would be just icing on the cake. But I really think the issue that they have to solve is that there's one universal way, central point for all of these, you know, devices to connect to. They need to be the hub of that wheel. And right now, they're not any of it. They don't do the software. They don't really do the devices. They don't do the hub. So all they really did was define kind of a specification in a way, a common way for all these third-party devices to talk to each other, which is great. I mean, that was another part of the problem. Before Apple brought in HomeKit, a lot of home automation systems was where you had to have one brand. You know, if you bought into Insteon, you only had Insteon things, or you only had X10, or, and there was a little bit of cross-pollination, but really there were a lot of big silos. Now, at least, you know, when you buy HomeKit devices, they're all going to work with other HomeKit devices, but it's still not that promise of that totally seamless plug-and-play experience. And I think to get there, really, it's the hardware side of things that I hope Apple focuses on. So while this was an interesting and fun rumor, turns out not to be true, I think it was a little misguided in terms of where the direction should be put. A French site is claiming to have production schematics of the upcoming iPhone 7 design. We've been talking about this for quite a while. Pretty much all the rumors are pointing to the fact that the iPhone 7 design is not going to change at all from the iPhone 6S designs that we currently have. And this certainly aligns with that and other rumors, because the outward size and appearance seems to remain largely unchanged. And a lot of people think that's going to be something that hinders sales. A lot of times when Apple comes out with the just number cycle, not the S cycle, that's when Apple's doing some of the bigger design changes. And it's looking like that's not going to happen this time around. The physical dimensions of this schematic are exactly the same as the iPhone 7, 2.64 by 5.44 inches. They don't give the thickness, oddly enough, but it's believed to be just a minuscule amount thinner than the current iPhone 6S design, but it's not going to make any difference in terms of cases and things like that. So it should be almost identical. All the port configurations, the cutout locations in the schematic are also the same. About the only thing that is different is the camera opening. The camera opening is still round, but it is slightly bigger. And also the camera opening seems to be more integrated into the case design. So you're still going to have the camera bump, but it's not going to look so much like just a lens inserted into a hole in the back of the device. It's more seamlessly merged into it. And a lot of the leaked sort of schematics and images that we've been seeing seem to be pointing to this. Now, the camera opening on the iPhone 7 Plus, which we've also seen, seems to have a larger oval-shaped or pill-shaped opening, which seems to track along with the rumor that it will be the 7 Plus exclusively that is going to get the dual camera lens system. And there is some other evidence this week that points to that being the case. There also is no 3.5 millimeter headphone jack, so that rumor is still floating around, although I will tell you it is a little bit in flux. We've seen some rumors pointing to a 3.5 millimeter jack being there, other ones to it not being there. Personally, I'm on the camp that I think Apple is going to axe the 3.5 millimeter headphone jack in this round. Now back to which model is going to get that dual lens system. Ming-Chi Kuo is reporting that Apple will just produce a single model of the iPhone 7 Plus. For a while, he was thinking there might be two different versions of it, one with the single lens system, one with a dual lens. Now he thinks it's just going to be the dual lens model, and that the iPhone 7 Plus will also have 3 gigabytes of RAM versus 2 gigabytes in the 4.7 inch version. So only the larger version is going to have those extra features. And he says that design constraints of the phone may limit, unfortunately, some of the optical zoom capabilities. So the good news there is, with the dual lens system on the 7 Plus, it's still expected that there will be some amount of optical zoom. It's just going to be a question on how much advantage are you going to get. And that comes down to, I guess, some design factors. It'll be interesting to see, too, what they can do in software with that extra RAM, the Lynx technology that Apple acquired that's going to allow the dual lens system. I think it's still going to be an amazing camera platform. Lynx supposedly has, you know, SLR quality lens system, and I think both actual lens designs are going to benefit from that technology. I'm a little disappointed that the dual lens is only going to be in the larger phone, because, as you know, I tried out the 5.5 inch form factor. I have no interest in actually going back to it personally, so I'm going to stick with the 4.7 inch even if I can't get the dual lenses. Maybe I'll have to hold out and wait for an iPhone 7 before we get it in that model. And it is going to be on the plus size, still the 5.5 inch form factor. There were some earlier hints of Apple doing a bigger design, like a 5.7, 5.8 inch design. I'm happy to report that it doesn't seem like that is going to be happening. So lastly, there are reports that Taiwanese suppliers are getting fewer parts orders in the buildup to the iPhone 7. This would be compared to the number of parts orders they were getting last year for the iPhone 6S designs. And that has led to speculation that maybe Apple is expecting sales of the iPhone 7 to not go so well. And TSMC, for example, is reportedly getting 30% fewer chip orders from Apple, and they are believed to be the sole supplier. I mean, they're currently the sole supplier of processors for the iPhone. So if that's the case, that would be a significant cutback. Now, here's the thing about parts orders, though. Tim Cook has often warned that watching supply chain, looking at where Apple is putting orders and how they're ordering and stuff like that, is a little bit of a fool's errand. That you can't look at that and make any deductions about how Apple is ramping up or getting ready to supply a release. And the reason is that Apple often uses multiple suppliers. They change up supplier orders. They do things in the supply chain that makes it very hard to piece together an entire complete picture. So you're really just looking through little pinholes at what is going on. And normally I would agree with that, but as I said, TSMC, if they really are getting 30% fewer orders, that is an indication of something. Now, is it an indication that the iPhone 7 is going to be a flop? Because that is the way a lot of news outlets are kind of spinning this news at this point, or this rumor at this point. I don't think that's going to be the case. I think the iPhone 7 is poised to do very well. We do know that iPhone sales have flattened off, that the 6S sales were a decline, which hasn't happened for a very long time for iPhone. And this time around, I think it's going to go back up, but I don't think we're ever going to get back to the launch levels of any prior iPhone. I think we're at that point where the iPhone's become a mature product. It's going to see nice, steady kind of sales, not really growth, not big amounts of decline, but probably a slow decline over the years. But because of the release cycle, I think what happens is iPhone 6 was huge for Apple. It was their biggest iPhone release ever in terms of sales. And I think all those people, or a lot of those people, I guess I should say more accurately, a lot of those people that bought iPhone 6s are going to be ready to upgrade when the iPhone 7 is launched. And Tim Cook has already also said there's going to be features in there. He told Jim Cramer this. There's going to be features in there that are going to make people want to upgrade, because that's often the thing that's also pointed to, is there's not a lot of innovation. I think that dual lens camera system is going to be huge. I think the camera technology is going to be the big seller in this release, and I think there's going to be a lot of people that want to upgrade for that. So are we going to see his numbers for iPhone as big as we have in past years? Likely not. Is it going to be a lot better than the iPhone 6S? I think yes. And, you know, only time is going to tell. But again, I don't think, you know, reading the tea leaves in the supply chain is any indication of how the iPhone 7 is going to do. The New York Times reported this week that Apple recently met with 7 top podcasters who expressed, quote, serious concerns over Apple's neglect of the podcasting business. The article seems to indicate that the trouble is that Apple has failed to provide reporting and analytics tools. They've not provided support for monetizing podcasts, specifically selling podcasts in iTunes, and that they make it harder for podcasters to get promotion in the podcast app or in iTunes. And they even point out that there is a single guy that everybody kind of pleads to get their podcast featured or put on the front page of iTunes. Now, as somebody who's been in the podcast business for 11 years, I can tell you, you know, some of this stuff is actually true. You know, and what they're talking about really mostly comes down to concerns, I think, about how to monetize, monetize in the podcast space, how to make money from podcasting. And, you know, frankly, as a podcaster who's been doing this for 11 years, long before, you know, Serial brought this conversation to the mainstream, a lot of these complaints, and I don't even want to call them complaints, a lot of these conversations are not new. We've been talking about this, you know, since the early days, about 4 years into podcasting, you know, everybody was trying to figure out monetization and can we make this a business? A lot of us started out, you know, doing it in our basements, or in my case, I started in a car studio. I mean, I literally recorded the podcast just in a car on my lunch hour, and it was kind of a hobby thing, but it's grown into a business. And the point is it has, you know, it's becoming a business. It's gaining more attention because of the success of things like Serial. And that's great. There's been actually many milestone events in the history of podcasting that has, you know, brought it up level after level. Apple support with iTunes was a huge one for a lot of us. And it's been many years since then. And so, you know, the complaints are frustrating to me because we don't know, one, who those top podcasters were, but I assume a lot of them were the heads of larger and more likely commercial podcast networks. So a lot of these guys already have access to a lot of promotional resources. They already have access to a lot of revenue. You know, this isn't us indie guys sort of doing this. This is like the big guys saying, Apple, you have to help us. And what they seem to be asking for, and the one thing that I hope Apple doesn't give them, is they seem to be asking for Apple to take ownership, more ownership and control over the podcasting marketplace. Apple is already kind of the big behemoth. And I think that's one reason why these podcasters wanted to talk to Apple, because they do have a lot of control in the space. But all of the things they were asking Apple to give them, you know, more access to analytics, more, you know, all this stuff that still exists inside the Apple ecosystem. And it's going to be a case of like, really, guys, careful what you wish for, because it would be terrible. It plays into their main complaint that Apple's control, you know, controls the only, quote, reliable way for a podcast to build audience. You know, that like, this is the play, Apple, you're the people we have to go to. So therefore, you have to help us. And I call that, you know, BS, to use the family friendly term. You know, Apple is not responsible for, nor do they really have the obligation to help me as a podcaster build my business or my audience. They've already provided me a great place for distribution. They've already provided a lot of tools with GarageBand and Logic and all the things that they do for me to be able to produce a podcast. They've been early, early supporters of podcasts. Like I said, when podcast support was added to iTunes, that was huge for all of us. But to be 100% fair, Apple technically does not control podcasting, and that is great. That's the way we want it. They just have this popular podcast directory and the most popular podcast player app, and that's because they got in early. Beyond that, all podcasters individually control every aspect of their content. I control my content and what's in my show. Apple doesn't tell me what I have to do. I control all of my feeds. I control my serving. I control where my audio files are. I control the relationships between my listeners and myself. I control the advertising and who can advertise on the show and who doesn't. I wouldn't want to be have to go through Apple for any of that stuff. They've been more than open. And, you know, if you get my show from a feed, that audio file comes from my servers. And guess what? I have all the stats. I can track all of that. So it really isn't Apple's place. And I hope Apple doesn't become the person that I have to go to get stats. They never dictate or actually control everything. Yes, they have a lot of pull in the space. Yes, they can decide if my podcast gets featured on the front page of iTunes or not. And thankfully, I'm one of the lucky ones. It has happened for me in the past. It doesn't happen all the time, but they hand curate that stuff. So a lot of that comes from my work and producing a show that someone in Apple is going to hear or see and deem is worthy of actually being, you know, bubbled up to the top. They're looking for quality content. They're looking for passionate shows and things like that. And I think those are the ones they've tended to support. And, you know, they don't have stats, for one thing, on anything outside of iTunes as well. So, you know, what they're going to ask for is something that Apple's only going to be able to say, okay, this is your part of the audience that subscribes through iTunes, that subscribes through one podcast, you know, our podcast app. But, you know, if you're using Overcast or Downcast or you're using Stitcher or using some other thing, you're not, those stats don't go to Apple. It's handed off. Once you subscribe in that app, the relationship is between that app and my servers and my feed. So, you know, the fact that they don't control all that stuff is really a good thing. And the fact that Apple is not doing more in the podcasting space, that they have ignored, you know, monetization and some of these other things, I think is actually a good thing. I think you can talk to a lot of app developers about, you know, how they sell their apps and how Apple controls that market space. And they would say, you know, you guys really probably don't want this. As far as a better, more standardized way of calculating, collecting, and reporting stats, I think that is a great goal. I just don't think Apple is the company that should be involved. I really feel that this should be something that would be a consortium of podcasters, of podcast hosting companies. Yes, Apple would be a part of that, but so should Google and Amazon and any other place that, you know, Microsoft, any other place that is going to promote podcasts or have podcasting built into their platform. It should be some of the app companies too, the podcatchers, the software developers, hosting companies, all those people. We all need to get into a room and figure this stuff out. But to let one company, Apple, set, define, and control everything, that would just make things a whole lot worse. We actually need less of Apple in podcasting, not more. And again, don't get me wrong, I'm incredibly grateful for Apple, to Apple, for everything that they've done for podcasting. They are the company that, you know, we owe a huge debt to. They're adding iTunes, you know, adding it to iTunes and supporting it was great. But it's time to enter the next phase of growth, and we need to step up, and we need to go outside of Apple to kind of help write the whole next chapter of podcasting. So, you know, I think it's great that Apple held this meeting, that they were willing to listen to these podcasters. I just hope that the vision is a little bit bigger than what was reported this week. You know, anything that, you know, in this business that's going to help grow it and promote it and make it possible for more people to get involved and make a living at it, I think is really good. To standardize some of the ways we talk about advertising and how we sell advertising and those sorts of things, these are all good goals. But again, there needs to be more people than just podcasters and Apple, because that's sort of where the ecosystem is now. We want to grow it to the next level. And that's just my thought on the story this week. Now, I'm not going to say it's as if I can predict the future, but if you listened to the last MacCast, we heard the story that, you know, Apple was trying to sell refurbished iPhones in India. They were trying to get permission to do that, and the Indian government said, no, we're not going to let you do that. There was a lot of pushback, not only from the government, but also from some of Apple's competitors in India. The idea being is that, you know, Apple just wants to, or what they felt was going on was that Apple just wanted to dump, you know, their excess inventory and phones into China, and it was going to create an environmental issue. From Apple's perspective, they were looking for, you know, continuing their growth in China. China has been a great market for iPhone. It's a growing market for iPhone. They're bringing on their 4G networks, cellular networks now, so it's just getting built out in the country. It's an area of huge potential, but it's also very price sensitive. So bringing in refurbished products would be a way for Apple to sell into that lower end of the market. But India also has a big focus on making sure that Indian companies do well within the region. And to promote that, you know, they don't like the idea of outside companies coming in and kind of controlling things. So, you know, there's some political things going on. And I mentioned last week that, you know, Apple has faced these kind of challenges in other places, one of those places being Brazil. And one way that they worked around some of the limitations in that market was to work with their partner Foxconn, have them open up a factory in Brazil, and then they get around some sort of tariff issues and things like that. It makes it easier to sell in the country. And I said, I bet they'll do the same thing in India. Well, the Economic Times of India this week says that Apple's iPhone supplier, Foxconn, guess what? Plans to open an iPhone manufacturing plant in India. They say the deal is in the works. It's not set yet, so they're still in talks. But if it does happen, they would plan to build about a $10 billion facility on about 1,200 acres of land, and it would take about 18 months to build. They're reportedly looking to not just do one factory, but Foxconn wants to open 10 to 12 facilities in India by 2020. As I said, India's had a big initiative to bring companies in, get stuff Indian made within the country. And they've been really protective about local Indian companies and have blocked or restricted outside companies in various ways. And Apple certainly felt that. So one good way to get around these restrictions would be to you know, build iPhones or make iPhones in India, build up some good faith, and get around some of the import tariffs and things like that. So that's a good benefit for Apple as well. So hopefully Apple will, you know, this isn't Apple directly investing in India, but Apple has also looked at opening some office space. I think we've talked about that as well. So certainly I think what's happening is that Apple sees India as a big future area of growth for iPhone. They've mentioned it several times. And as a matter of fact, in the second quarter numbers, which were pretty bad for iPhone, we saw sales declines in almost every region, but iPhone sales were up 56% in India that same quarter. So Apple's going to want to grow the business over there. And this is just another step that they can take with their partner Foxconn to get there. I want to talk about what I'm calling Siri's little sister, Viv. There was new technology shown off at TechCrunch Disrupt this week. Viv Labs, which is headed by former Siri co-creator Dan Kitlaus, showed off their new technology. Now, it's really not fair, I think, if you watch the video, to simply call this another digital assistant. And it's probably not fair for me to call it Siri's sister, because Apple bought the Siri technology from Siri Labs. This is now Viv Labs, a separate company. DAG and a couple people left Apple after Siri was acquired, and they formed this new company, and they've been working on this system. And what the system is it can not only understand and parse complex language, but it can actually break down your request on the fly. And not only that, it on the fly creates the program that is going to process the request of what you're asking it to do. So it not only understands, it's got the voice recognition from Nuance, you know, the same technology that Apple uses, but then it takes that, it puts it into a system, it breaks it up, it tries to figure out which services can respond to your request, and then it quickly writes a program on the fly using the Viv Labs technology to actually then run itself and figure out what it wants you to do. So consequently, it can almost learn in a certain way as new services are plugged into the platform. And really the key is that it's an open platform. So web and cloud services providers have APIs, they have a way to tap into the system where they can open up the data and functionality of their platform into the Viv technology. So they have worked with companies like Uber, for example, or Weather Underground, or Google. You know, anybody can take their endpoints, their technology, and plug it into this system using this sort of language and this programming platform that they've built up. And Viv will immediately be able to acquire and start to write programs based on the language parsing that when it's appropriate to go out and get that that service, it can interact with it. And it doesn't require writing any new programming on the Viv side. It can simply just build that into its system. And so it was a very impressive demo. You can actually see the video over at TechCrunch, but immediately after this sort of went out, a lot in the tech community and a lot of Apple watchers were crying and saying, well, this is where Siri technology should be by now. But here's the thing, you know, Siri is not Viv. And personally, I think it's by design. And I think one of the reasons why the Viv guys left Apple was because I've heard that this technology was already in the roadmap for Siri. They were already planning on building the system under Siri, but Apple actually chose not to pursue it. And even if that isn't the case, I don't think that Siri could ever have these Viv-like capabilities because of Apple's strong stance on customer data privacy. Because if you look at the platform, if you watch this video, Viv relies on the cloud, but not its own cloud. It relies on the cloud outside of itself, all these other outside services, and it relies on openly sharing data and information with those services to be able to work. And to get those relationships in place, you probably also have to agree to give a certain amount of information back. And Apple has been always very protective in making sure that, you know, our private information isn't handed off to some other service. Yes, Apple has integration and Siri has integration with some strategic partners, but it's under a very strict set of guidelines. And Viv is much more open. And So for the same privacy reasons, I don't think Apple will try to acquire the Viv technology. And that's been floated around since the story broke as well, that, well, Apple should just buy Viv and bring this in and integrate it in with Siri. And I also think from the Viv side, if you watch the video, I don't think they would be interested in selling to Apple again, because they are really hoping and they see the power of Viv in being this open platform, it being available. They talk about ubiquity. So it needs to be available on any platform, on any device, anywhere, working all of the same. And that really is, you know, one of the limitations of where we're at with voice technology and assistant technology right now. You have a lot of people saying, well, you know, the Amazon Echo is amazing. It can do a lot of stuff. But again, remember the Amazon Echo, much more open platform. A lot of data is being shared, your personal data with, you know, partners of Amazon and things like that. You also have the Microsoft technology, you know, Google's technology. And the issue is they all work differently. They all don't work together. And the Viv system is really designed to not be any one of those things. It would interact with, it can interact with Google or Yahoo or Amazon. And that's the idea behind it. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see if they can roll it out and have that ubiquity in when each company they're going to want to partner with is going to want to maybe control part of it. But I think where they're going to start, and if you look at who their partners are right now, they're going to start at a lower level. They're going to start with cloud services for weather endpoints or travel endpoints. You know, the airlines they'll go to. They'll go to companies like Uber and Lyft. You know, they're not going to try and just work within one vertical with one partner like Apple or Amazon or Google. They're going to go straight to where the data is that they want Viv to be able to react with. And it really was about sort of Viv learning a lot about you and becoming the true personal assistant that I think we all wish Siri could be, but I'm not really sure Siri will be able to be. You know, so a great example is something like if I'm planning a trip, being able to say, hey, Viv, I would like to take a trip to San Francisco next weekend. Can you get me a flight? And just in that one statement, the way the Viv technology works is she would know, okay, Apple's or Adam's favorite airline for traveling to San Francisco is Virgin. He likes to pay between this amount and that amount for a ticket. He likes to sit on an aisle seat and he likes to fly in the morning rather than in the evening. And she can take all of that, parse it, and knows to go out to Virgin Airlines, knows to order an aisle seat, and knows that I don't want to pay more than $150. And she can come back and say, all right, I've ordered you your ticket. Because guess what? She also has my credit card information, and I simply then get a notification, hey, your trip is all set. You have a flight, 9 a.m., aisle seat to San Francisco, you know, on Friday. So you'll be there this weekend. And same thing for ordering hotels and stuff like that. So it's that kind of, you know, power and technology. But, you know, there's a lot that has to be given up in terms of privacy. So, you know, I don't think we're going to see that there. There are still hopes that Apple may at least open up the Siri platform, the API, to third-party developers at WWDC. Again, I think that'll probably happen, but it's going to be in a much more and very controlled way. So she'll be able to talk to applications on the phone. As far as like going out to outside services, there's some of that, but she's not going to be able to share the kind of data to do the kinds of personalization I think that Viv is going to do. And that's going to hinder developers somewhat with the technology. But Siri does have access to local data on our devices. And I've always been surprised that Apple hasn't tapped into that stuff. Say things like calendars. She could be much smarter about, you know, certain queries just based on data that is kept primarily on the phone. One of my big frustrations is I put, you know, location data, map data into my appointments in the calendar, and I still can't ask Siri for directions to my next meeting. She knows what my next meeting is. She has the direction data, but Apple hasn't tied those two things together. So Siri can go a lot further even within the sandbox that she's in. But I was happy to hear this week from one of you based on something we talked about last week, that Siri does have a little more smarts than I originally thought.
Hey, Adam. It's Colin Campbell from Dublin, Ireland. I just wanted to drop you a quick comment. I was listening to last week's show, and you were chatting about the Apple Watch and replies via text on the Apple Watch being smart enough and clever enough to give you a response with the different European languages. Well, similar to that vein, it was my mum's birthday last week, and I went to send her a happy birthday message from my Apple Watch, and lo and behold, the first option in the pre-filled out text fields was happy birthday, which I thought was pretty clever and something I didn't notice before. Thanks very much for your good work, and yeah, keep it up.
Thanks, Colm. Yeah, that was something that I would not have expected as well, but after I received your message, it made a whole lot of sense, because Siri does know about our relationships because we might have those in our contacts data, and they also do know about birth dates, which is also, I think, kept in the contacts data for some people. So if you've added that, I would imagine she can deduce, or you know, the technology can deduce, yeah, you might be, when you're trying to text your mom today, very likely the one thing you might want to text her is happy birthday. So to be able to offer that up real quick and easy like that is exactly how we want these digital assistants to work. And I think, you know, the Viv technology being shown off just reminds us that, you know, Siri has become a pretty good assistant, but where Apple has fallen a little bit short, I think, is on the personal side of things. And I think some of that, again, is their own little limitations that they've imposed on themselves. But I do think some of it, too, is they haven't advanced the technology using the capabilities that they have enough quite yet either. So WWDC is right around the corner. I have high hopes that we're going to see some new Siri technologies. Whether or not that means a third-party API, you know, that would be great. But really, I'd just like to see Apple even internally taking Siri and pushing her to the next level. So maybe something between Siri and Viv. So maybe Siri can grow up a little bit and become the big sister to her older sister. Maybe that's the better way to put it, the older sister to Viv. Good news this week for those of you in Canada. On May 10th, some banks started supporting Apple Pay. If you have a Visa, MasterCard, Amex, or Interac card with Amex Bank of Canada, RBC, CIBC, or ATB, you should be able to use your Apple Pay now. TD Canada Trust, BMO, and Scotiabank have said they will enable Apple Pay in June. So if you're with one of those providers, you're not quite there yet. But that's a pretty big rollout in Canada. And, you know, as with the U.S., which kinds of cards and payment methods are supported are going to vary from bank to bank. For example, you know, my bank still does not support my business MasterCard. So while I can use my business debit card, for whatever reason, MasterCard isn't supported, but my MasterCard on another provider is. So it's a little bit confusing. I don't know why one bank chooses to support one kind of card and maybe not another, but you're going to see a little bit of that variance. And, you know, our friends down in Australia, we reported last week, I think, that Australia's ANZ Bank started supporting Apple Pay. Well, there's a report on MacNN that says since launching that, there has been a marked increase in bank account and credit card applications for ANZ Bank. ANZ's CEO said that attempts to apply for a new credit card online increased by 20% since they announced Apple Pay support. And on the day of the announcement, he says that Apple Pay drove the number of online deposit applications, I would assume this means applications for bank accounts, to double what they are on a normal daily average rate. So this reportedly has sparked other banks in Australia to step up their negotiations with Apple. Apple's been actually trying to sign banks in Australia for a while, but there's been a sticking point, and that is because most regions outside the U.S., don't collect the same level of fees for their banking transactions or for their credit card transactions, the banks at least don't, that is collected in the U.S. And Apple wants part of that fee as their part of Apple Pay. So when a bank takes on Apple Pay, Apple wants typically 0.15% per transaction. So basically 15 cents on every $100 that is charged through the credit card. Well, a U.S. bank typically gets 1% of the credit card transaction amount. So that would still leave them with about 0.85% after they give Apple their cut. But outside the U.S., the rates are much lower. And for example, in Australia, reportedly banks only get about 0.5% per transaction. So if Apple still takes 0.15%, it's a much larger percentage of the small percentage that the bank is already getting. They just get about 45 cents on every $100 worth of transactions. And that seriously cuts down, you know, if they were making, or 35 cents rather, if they were making 50 cents before, they're now only making 35 cents. And that's been kind of the sticking point and the thing that Apple has been trying to work through. But supposedly now that ANZ Bank, and we don't know the terms that ANZ Bank got, but now that they are seeing this this increase in interest because they have Apple Pay, the other banks are saying, oh, we better get on board. And supposedly they're a little more willing to work things out for with Apple now. So hopefully if you're in Australia and you're with a different bank, maybe your bank will be getting Apple Pay relatively soon, thanks to ANZ Bank. There was an interesting and somewhat puzzling to me rumor this week from Digital Music News that said Apple is considering either a 2-year or a 3 to 4 year timeline for shutting down digital downloads or purchases on iTunes. The belief being that streaming is kind of becoming the future. It's the way that most people are buying their music, or more people, more accurately, probably are choosing to buy their music. And that Apple is considering or looking at the timeline on, you know, when are we going to stop actually selling music and just go with streaming only. I found it a little bit interesting because it would fly definitely directly in the face of Steve Jobs, who always held the belief that people wanted to own their music. And for a long time, I think Apple at large, that was their big philosophy. But of course, with streaming here now, Spotify and now Apple Music, and we're kind of seeing the trend change, I think a lot of people at Apple are thinking the same thing. So I have no doubt that this conversation has been going on and has been coming up from time to time. But as far as Apple actually pulling the trigger and shutting down iTunes downloads, I think, you know, that's not going to happen anytime soon. You know, thinking about something and actually choosing to act on it are very different things. But the discussion is supposedly focused on really what's the timeline that we're looking at. You know, when is this going to happen? And maybe trying to make preparations for, you know, what happens when we get to the point where streaming is the majority of the business? At what threshold, you know, at what sales level do we say, you know what, we're not making enough money on the downloads to continue to sell downloads? And certainly that would be a smart conversation for Apple to be, you know, having at this point. The thought is that what would happen is that they would slowly kind of shut it down over regions, starting with tier one regions like the US and the UK, and then progressively roll it out into other countries over a period of years. So it's not going to be an overnight, you know, suddenly they're not selling purchases or downloads on the service. And I think the biggest point of contention when the story broke with for a lot of people was that many sources were reporting Apple was planning on shutting it down in 2 years. And some industry insiders have said estimates for iTunes music downloads are that the business will still be worth about $600 million even by 2019. So what, that's 3 years from now. That's still a considerable business. So to think that Apple would simply turn it off in just a couple years, I think is a little bit crazy. It could be 4, 5, 6, 8 years out. Who really knows? Or who even knows if it will happen at all? You know, my kind of theory is that there's not a lot of extra overhead at this point for allowing people to buy music if they want to buy music. You can have a streaming service that's 90% of the business and a download service that's 10% of the business and still have both be successful businesses. And especially considering that Apple has already built all of the infrastructure, distribution, the payment system, you know, it's already all in place. So you can, there's very little cost in keeping it running. And I guess that's really what it comes down to, is what are the day-to-day operational costs for iTunes, you know, selling music on iTunes. And only Apple really knows those numbers. And really, that's, I think, what this analysis is all about. And an Apple spokesman did come out and tell Recode that the report that Apple would stop selling music downloads is simply, quote-unquote, not true. And I think that's accurate. They're not going to stop selling downloads, at least not in the near future. But I think where there could be some truth, as I said in the story, is that Apple's at least thinking about it. They're making a plan. They're planning, you know, 5-10 years out. What's the business going to look like? What are we going to do? And there's no problem, or I have no concerns about having, you know, plans in place for the future. I think that's, you know, what a company should be doing. And then finally in the news for this week, Apple Watcher Neil Seibert says that Apple's R&D spending is up about 30% from 2015, and they're currently spending about $10 billion on R&D. Now, he also notes that just 4 years ago, Apple was spending only about $3 billion annually on R&D. And so his theory is that this is a sign that Apple is working on, quote unquote, pivoting into something big. And that something big, as you might speculate, is probably the Apple Car. And he talks about that a little bit in the piece. But I wanted to talk a little bit more about this speculation that, you know, something big is happening because Apple is spending huge amounts more on R&D. And if you look at Apple's R&D spending amounts as they relate to their net sales, you'll see that they're devoting roughly the same percentage. It's actually up about 2%, which is significant because it's almost double the amount of R&D spending as a function of net sales. But it's pretty natural that R&D spending tied to net sales is just related to, it's a bigger business. They have to spend more money on R&D to kind of keep it going. And he does talk about this in the piece, and he talks about the theory as to why he doesn't think that's simply what's going on. You know, and certainly Apple seems to be investing in many large projects. We have the whole Apple Car thing, which I think is where a lot of the money is going. They have investments in their chip technologies. They have their environmental projects. I mean, Liam had to cost a pretty penny to put together. We saw him recently, and Apple has obviously done a lot of spending in there. There's all the spending in other environmental efforts, building out data centers and technologies that go in there. And there's a lot of speculation that Apple's also working on artificial intelligence. They're working on VR technologies. So them investing this kind of money, I think, is a good thing. But it leads to the question of, well, what are they spending all this on? What is the next big thing, right? And we've been talking about that quite a bit. But another possible take on this R&D spending that I thought about was that, you know, is Apple, and this is playing devil's advocate a little bit, you know, I don't really believe this, but, you know, some people could look at the amount of spending and the increase in spending and say, well, are they trying to spend their way to the next big thing? It's not a bad investment or a bad thing to do, but you could argue that in the past, Apple spent less because they had a plan, they had a vision, they knew what was going to be next, and they were already kind of working on it, and they could really focus their spending. But now they seem to be spending a lot of money in a lot of different areas. So are they spending that just to kind of seek out and figure out what the next big technology is? Maybe they don't really know. Maybe this supports that argument that a lot of people are pointing to, that, you know, Apple doesn't have what's next already on the game plan. Again, I don't think that's happening. I think Apple has very targeted efforts. And I think, again, the fact that they're spending in a number of different areas is just a function of where the business is going. And I think they've always done this in the past too. They've always had research projects. What's amazing about Apple is they're not afraid to spend the money. And if something doesn't work out, they're not afraid to kill it. And another thing that I think, and we've spoken to this on the podcast in the past, I think another thing is that even if they are investing large amounts of money into an electric car or an autonomous vehicle or whatever the car project is, it doesn't necessarily mean that if they don't build a car, it's a failure, because a lot of the technologies that are going to be developed, a lot of the things that they're going to be exploring in that project have applications in other parts of Apple's business or other future businesses. So, you know, they could end up selling systems or autonomous technologies to other companies. It could be a whole nother part of their business. So it's definitely not going to be money that's lost. And, you know, Apple's R&D spending, I think, is ultimately a good thing. Another thing, not directly related to R&D spending, but another thing that happened this week was Apple announced that they made an investment in what many are calling the Chinese Uber, or a competitor to Uber in China. And it may, among other things, be a kind of, in my opinion, almost outsourced R&D. Apple made a $1 billion investment in Didi Chuxing, which is the biggest ride-sharing service in China. They own about 85%, I think, of the ride-sharing market, although Uber is just coming into China now, so we'll see how that pans out. But in a statement, Tim Cook said that Apple had several strategic reasons for this investment. He said, one, it's to learn more about certain segments of the Chinese market. He also expects that the investment will see a pretty strong return, so they're expecting big things out of Didi Chuxing. I keep worrying I'm going to mess up that name, but I think I'm getting that right. He also says the deal, quote, reflects our excitement about their growing business and also our continued confidence in the long term in China's economy. And that is something that was called into question during Apple's results call is, you know, does Apple think that the economy in China is going to be a problem for them? And Tim Cook said no in that meeting. And I think, you know, spending and investing $1 billion in a Chinese company is another big, you know, really tangible way for them to show, hey, we believe in China. We believe in China's economy. But I think that last part also may be the biggest reason for Apple's investment. It's to show the Chinese government that Apple is interested in the future of China and the economy. Apple has had a couple run-ins with the Chinese government recently. They had the iTunes, you know, iMovie store or the movie store shut down, the bookstore shut down. They've been wanting to do more things with iPhone. And I think investing in a Chinese company sort of shows goodwill and good faith and can only help with Apple's continued negotiations with the government. So Cook insisted that Apple continues to focus on the in-car experience with technology like CarPlay. So they're kind of trying to play off the fact that this may be also related to their car efforts. But I certainly think that it's another big advantage of this deal that Apple can work with somebody who is driving a lot of cars in China, working with a lot of people who are riding in cars in China, and can kind of see how the market feels about vehicles. Obviously, if Apple's going to make an electric car, they have to think about the markets that they're going to be selling into and what people in those markets want in terms of vehicles and technologies and things like that. So they can get a lot of data out of this as well. But it also brought up a couple other theories, and I've seen some others floating these around, but I thought exactly the same thing, is that one idea is that, you know, maybe Apple isn't actually making a car for you and I to buy. Maybe they're actually making a car for companies like Uber, ride-sharing companies, or companies like Didi Chuxing to have driverless car service. So it could be an autonomous electric vehicle or maybe just an autonomous vehicle that could be controlled by these companies. They could take the driver part out of the equation, and Apple could set up an entire car service where you and I don't have to buy a car anymore. We simply rent or use time in one of these smart autonomous vehicles that Apple has. And it could be a monthly subscription service. It could be a pay-as-you-go kind of thing. There's a lot of business models that could crop up around this sort of thing. Or, you know, maybe it's just a pure car sharing thing. I don't know. But there is a lot with this partnership that Apple is doing that they could potentially benefit from. So it's interesting to see what Apple is doing. It does seem to kind of confirm a lot of these rumors that Apple's very interested in the automotive, in the car space. I mean, if you're going to invest $1 billion in something, you have to be pretty interested in it. So that's a pretty big investment, although in the grand scheme of things with Apple's, you know, $232 billion, I think, cash on hand now, it really is kind of a drop in the bucket for them. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is FreshBooks. Hey, look, if you run your own business, if you're self-employed like I am, you know one of the biggest hassles that you typically have is dealing with your invoicing, dealing with getting payments, getting paid. FreshBooks is a great way to make your life a lot simpler in that regard. They can allow you to spend less time on paperwork and more time growing your business, which is exactly what you want. Using FreshBooks, it takes just about 30 seconds to create and send an invoice. And with that invoice, you can completely customize it. You can add your own logo. You can add your own color scheme so that it reflects your brand, so that your messaging stays consistent. And not only that, once your client receives your invoice, FreshBooks gives them the ability to pay you directly online, which can seriously improve how fast you get paid. How many times have you had it where you sent out an invoice and you spent so much time trying to get the client to pay it, trying to track them down, find out if they got your invoice? FreshBooks will tell you whether or not your client has opened up and looked at that invoice. It's that kind of data that can really help you. They can also send late payment reminders for you automatically, so you're not having to go back in and check, oh, did they pay me? Did they send that check? Don't worry about it. FreshBooks will handle that for you, so you're not chasing down clients. You can also use FreshBooks to directly deposit the money right into your bank account. So once you get paid, it goes right in. You can also track things like prepayments. You can track and do renewal payments. So if you have somebody who's on retainer or who is on a monthly maintenance program, it will handle that for you as well. And you can do all of this from anywhere, any device, your desktop, an iPhone, an iPad, an Android device, and your data is always backed up, you know, something that I am a big fan of, and kept secure. And best of all, FreshBooks is offering a month of unrestricted use to all MacCast listeners totally free right now, and you don't even need a credit card to try it out. So I don't know why you would wait. To claim your free month, all you have to do is go to freshbooks.com/MacCast, and then just enter MacCast in the How Did You Hear About Us section when you sign up. And that's going to get you the free trial. You can try it all out. You don't have to take my word for it, but it is a great service. It is going to completely help your business, and you really should check it out. And a big thank you to FreshBooks for their support of the MacCast. I'll tell you, every once in a while on the MacCast, a topic comes up and we start to get a lot of feedback. We start to get a lot of back and forth from the community. And this one surprised me a little bit because I thought it was kind of just a simple little story or simple, I guess. What usually triggers it is me making some comments and sharing a firm opinion or a strong opinion on something. And this time around, it was wireless charging. So it did surprise me a little bit because I thought it would be just a kind of a one-off little thing. But I've really appreciated the back and forth that we've had on this. And this week was no exception. I got a couple other pieces of feedback on wireless charging that I wanted to share with you. So we're going to start off first with a comment from Bob.
Hey, Adam, I'm calling in about, I heard on the last podcast about wireless charging. You wanted some thoughts and opinions about it. And originally, currently with the current technology, I am with you. I think it's gimmicky. I don't think that it is something that I'm interested in right now. But the future of it, I think, is what's compelling for me. And we have to get there somewhere. So I travel a lot. I also go to a lot of conference room meeting type things. I don't think that wireless charging is that beneficial for the nightstand type use, but imagine if at airports now you didn't have to bring a cable and they just had tables and you could set your phone on the table and it starts charging. It's compatible with all devices. That's a huge thing for me, is just the universality of it. If all phones could charge with the same thing, nobody needs a cable, and they could just set phones on tables and they start charging. And then the other thing is, you know, you go to a meeting with a lot of people in a conference room and there's a big conference table. Most people will set their phones on the table during the meeting. And if that table had little charging pucks or whatever, or, you know, they were built into the table so it still looks sleek and nice, we're already setting our phones on the table anyway. Might as well be charging while they're doing that. Nobody needs a cord hanging around doing that. So that's my thought. I think the future of it is interesting, and just the universal charging ability where you don't have to carry around different cords and different devices and that kind of thing. So hope that helps. Thanks, Adam.
Hey, Bob. Yeah, that's interesting thing to think about. And I think what you're getting at is something that, you know, I think I'm excited about the promise of wireless charging as well. I just don't think, you know, I would agree with you. I don't think where the current wireless technology is right now really makes a lot of sense. And while I see your point about, and it would be great if at the airport I could just, you know, set my phone on a surface and then it would be charging instantly, or at a restaurant or at, you know, a lot of public spaces. The problem with that is it still kind of relies on the phone being in a specific spot. So if I want to hang out by the gate, I may or may not have that option. I might still have to go to some sort of charging station. And it, once again, at that point, is it really that much more difficult to just plug in? So it really depends on where the access and the outlets are. But if you can get to that true point of ubiquity, that's very interesting. And I also did get a voicemail from Gary this week, although because we have him on the show so frequently, I was not going to play it this week. But I wanted to comment on what he was commenting about, because he talked about some other technology that exists out there called wireless absorption technology. And I've heard about this as well. I think there's some companies that are working on this. This would be more true kind of wireless, wireless charging, where it actually works over a certain distance. Now, the problem is there's a pretty significant drop off, I think, with the current technologies. So it's something that they're working on. But the idea here is that we have wireless signals and we have this stuff flying around us all the time. What if we could actually tap into that and use that for power? So you wouldn't need necessarily extra equipment, or you could have extra things sending out signals, but what if your device could just pick up on that and use that? And these would be really small, you know, micro charges. So probably not enough to charge your phone back up, but would be enough to continue to extend the battery life, make it work longer, make the internal battery not have to work so hard. And I remember being at CES probably like 10 years ago, and there was also a company that was working on plastics that would be able to use the light in a room to actually deliver a charge to a device. So you could build the case out of this material, and when it was set there on the desk in the conference room, out of the fluorescent lights, it could pick up a micro charge. And again, not necessarily for charging the device, but more for extending the life of the existing battery that's in there, making it last, you know, 30%, 40%, 50% longer. And I'm a little bit more excited about that kind of technology. So it'd be interesting to see Apple working in that direction more so than working on, you know, just I still have to set my phone in a given point. But I certainly see, you know, what you're trying to say in terms of convenience. If every surface that I ever went to had charging built into it, that this would be awesome. But I just don't see that happening. That's a big infrastructure. That's sort of like the electric car problem, right? Is we've got to build out electric charging stations that are fast and everywhere. And that's going to take a really long time. But maybe if we can tap into technologies where it's already ubiquitous, the light in rooms around us, or, you know, the Wi-Fi signals that are already flying around, that becomes really interesting. And I'd like to see Apple pursue that kind of stuff. And I also did get some feedback on this from Danny this week, and this is what he had to say.
Hey, Adam, this is Danny from Arkansas. Just wanted to give you a little feedback. You were mentioning about the wireless charging. Wondering if you're crazy. You're not crazy, Adam. You're not crazy at all, okay? Me and you are, I don't know how old you are. I'm 52. You may be a little younger than that, but you're old enough to know how to tie your own shoes. So am I. This world is the most lazy, got the most lazy people in the world. You're not crazy, Adam. Anyway, no, I really think wireless charging is really cool. I mean, it sounds really cool, but for all the reasons you mentioned, I'm not really getting it either. I think it's just getting a little ridiculous. Now, that being said, I do have a son who's handicapped. He has use of his hands, but he struggles. For somebody like him, if it was to snap into place with magnets and a light come on showing that it was there and all that, it might be a good thing. I'm not discounting it. And I think it's cool technology, really do, but do I care if it's in the next phone? No, I really don't. I think plugging it in, using my iPad charger, shoving my phone, it charges in a couple hours or less. It charges really fast. The only thing I disagree with you in is redundancy. If they had wireless charging, I still want my lightning port to be able to charge it. I really do. I want them both. You know, if one goes down, I want the other one. I want to be able to charge your phone. But other than that, I agree with you 100%. Don't really get it, but it'll be interesting to see what they do. You know, it really will be. So thank you for your work and enjoy your podcast. So, hey, thanks a lot and take care. Goodbye.
Hey, thank you very much for sending in your comment. I appreciate it. And just a couple things there. I totally agree with you. I don't know if I made it clear in the last podcast that I think if Apple does do a wireless solution, I think we're still going to have a lightning connector. I don't think the lightning connector is going away this time. So I think you are going to have both. My only point was that in having both, they create redundancy. So I was more on the side of why have the wireless charging if you're going to have the Lightning port anyway. But as you pointed out, and was pointed out last week by another listener, I didn't really think about the accessibility issue. That for people who have mobility challenges or visual challenges, that this is a technology that might be able to help out. So, you know, there are some advantages. And as you said, the technology itself is compelling, and I'm not discounting it. I am just saying that I think it's not where we really want it to be. But as was pointed out by Bob, maybe it is just the kind of thing where you've got to get it deployed, you've got to get it in devices so that some of these other things can happen. You've got to push the technology forward, sort of like Apple did with the USB connector. So I can see it from that standpoint. I'm not going to be upset or angry if Apple goes with wireless charging. I just feel like I'm probably not going to use it all that much as long as they keep that Lightning connector in there. If they do force us onto pure wireless charging, I think it's going to be a little bit more challenging, and I will have a little bit of frustration with that, I think. But right now, the rumors are all pointing, I don't think that's going to happen. I think we're going to end up with a Lightning connector. I don't think we're getting wireless charging. I also don't think we're going to get the smart connector. A lot of people have pointed out that the smart connector might be another kind of charging connector that would be on there. And I certainly, and I think I said this last time too, hopefully we don't get three different kinds of ways to charge our phone. I think that just adds to consumer confusion. And again, you're taking up extra space in the device, extra cost, all these other things that I don't think you need to spend money on. But I certainly appreciate everybody who sent in feedback on wireless charging. Keep sending it in. I think we're probably going to move on from this topic after today's episode. But, you know, certainly welcome to keep the conversation going in the forum at forum.maccast.com if you like, or ping me on Twitter, any place else, maybe in the Maccast community on Google+ or Facebook. That's another great place to have this conversation and continue it. But again, thanks to everybody for sending in your feedback and your comments. Another story I wanted to follow up on from last week was the story about the guy's deleted iTunes library or music library. There was a lot of hubbub being made last week that somebody had reported they were using Apple Music. When they turned it on, Apple Music completely deleted the local library on their Mac in iTunes and messed up all of their music. And we talked about this on the last show. If you want to hear what the results of that were, but to be clear, as we talked last week, it was pretty much confirmed that this was not an Apple Music issue, but iTunes and the circumstances that this guy experienced, we're now finding out, do not seem to be isolated. There are other people that are reporting who are reporting seeing this phenomenon, and I think I mentioned last week that it wasn't clear that iTunes didn't potentially have a bug, that there may be an iTunes bug. And it's looking now like that is very likely the case. And it seems to be an issue with the very most recent version of iTunes, 12.3.3. And it's looking like it may contain a database error that affects a small number of users. And this was kind of confirmed by iMore. And actually, it was Serenity Caldwell at iMore that pointed out that, no, you know, Apple Music is not designed to go through and delete your local library when you turn it on. That is absolutely not the case. But as some have reported, their music collection does seem to get deleted after the update. And what happens is if the local library gets deleted and you've subscribed to Apple Music, Apple Music does have some bugs, and we talked about this last week as well, where in some cases the matching isn't quite exact. So you'll end up with incorrect tracks. You might end up with a live track on a studio album or different versions of a track, or, you know, they'll be in different formats, which that actually is a feature of iCloud Music Library. If you turn on iCloud Music Library and you have a track that was, say, in uncompressed AIFF format, it gets uploaded to the iCloud Music Library if it's not matched as an AAC file, and that is by design. And then the files that come back down are in a DRM format. But the issue is that if you delete your local music library, and again, we talked about this last week, then all you have are the copies that are stored up in iCloud, and you can pull those back down, but those may not be the same. So you never, ever want to delete that local library. But because of this obscure bug that appears to affect some users in iTunes 12.3.3, it deletes that local library. So what happens is the person goes back in, they're using iTunes. iTunes acts as if nothing's wrong because it's just streaming or pulling the music down from the iCloud music library. So it's really not clear what's going on until it's too late. And then you think, oh my God, iTunes or Apple Music deleted my local music library. So if you've upgraded to iTunes 12.3.3, you can check your local music library and see if you got impacted by this bug by turning on the iCloud status in the iCloud download columns in iTunes. And you can look at those and just verify that all your music is still there locally. Of course, you could also just go into your music folder, into your home folder, or wherever you store your iTunes files and make sure that all of your files are there. If for some reason you got hit by this bug and your local music is not there, the best thing to do is just go to your backups, restore your local music files, and you should be fine. You shouldn't be affected by this. But Apple did confirm to The Loop that they are aware of this issue happening in, quote, an extremely small number of cases, and that they are taking these reports very seriously. And while at this point they've been unable to reproduce the issue, they did say that they're releasing an update for iTunes next week that's going to have some additional safeguards. We don't know exactly what they are, but that will supposedly help with the situation. But the bottom line is that, you know, really, if there's a bug in iTunes that's deleting local iTunes music libraries, this is a huge problem for Apple. This is a really big deal. And even if it's just affecting, you know, 0.0001% of the users, this kind of thing should never be happening. And it's just another kind of black eye for iTunes. And it's another frustration that I think, you know, it's another thing to add onto the pile of frustrations that a lot of iTunes users are feeling. And I made a joke last week that, you know, iTunes is too big, needs to fail. And what I mean by that is it really is, I think, time for Apple to take a deep look at iTunes. I think it's gone neglected for way too long. It's become way too big a piece of bloatware where it gets very hard to kind of track down. You end up with these kinds of secure bugs and issues, these really edge cases, because the code base has just existed for so long and it's been bolted onto and bolted onto. I'm really surprised it's taken Apple this long to really look at iTunes and figure out some way to go in and fix it. And it's going to be painful no matter what. They're going to have to go in, blow it up from scratch. I mean, if you think the move from from iPhoto to Photos was bad, or the move from iMovie to iMovie 10, or the move to Final Cut 10 was bad, this is going to be 3 times, 4 times, 5 times worse than that. But it's a pain, I think, that we all are going to have to go through, so that in the end, we end up with something a lot better in the long run. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, the future of iTunes and music on OS 10. Certainly on iOS, it's a little bit different. But at the same time, this is a pain point that I think it's high time Apple needs to address. And I'm sure some of you have some thoughts and opinions on that. If you want to chime in on that, shoot me an email, an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. Another item that I brought up last week was, actually over the past couple weeks, was I made a comment that, you know, I'm a big supporter of not always having to upgrade my equipment or my devices. I do it in a lot of cases because I enjoy doing it. I like having the latest, newest things and toys to play around with. It's actually, for me, part of what I do. It's part of my job, being able to talk to you about the latest iPhone or iPad. But for example, my MacBook Pro, that's my daily driver that I do this podcast on, is a 2011 MacBook Pro. And it works great for me. I have no thoughts or need for upgrading it. And so I don't see why I should spend the money if, you know, I'm not going to get any benefit. I did pay to put about $150 to put an SSD in it, and it felt like a brand new machine. And it shows no sign of age or wearing out. The battery still works really, really well, and I continue to use it. And I kind of encourage people to, hey, if you can use your machine a little bit longer, if you're happy with it, there's no need to run out and upgrade. And we don't need to feel like, oh, we have to upgrade. You've got a 3-year-old Mac. Wow, that's an ancient dinosaur. You need to upgrade that thing. And sometimes in our community, that mentality seeps in, that drive, that race to always have the latest and greatest thing, and it becomes a pressure for a lot of people. And a lot of people, I think, spend money needlessly, and it can cause financial problems, issues. You know, people will get things on credit, and I just don't see a need to continue to drive that thing. And also, we talked a little bit about, hey, maybe there's some other sources. You can buy a refurbished Mac, maybe save some money that way. So we're talking about money saving issues and stuff like that. But Nick chimed in and he had some points to make. We did this on Twitter. And so I tried to convey some of his thoughts and ideas, but I didn't get everything, I think, accurate. And I think it's really best to hear from the horse's mouth. So luckily, Nick sent me in an audio comment this week. And here was a couple of his follow-up comments.
Hi, Adam. Nick from London here. One big point you missed from my recommendation to sell your Mac gear every 1 to 2 years and buy new is that you also no longer really need AppleCare, as you will always have a valid free warranty on your Apple devices. In fact, in EU law, it states all products get a free 2-year warranty, and Apple stores usually are really good at fixing stuff for free that's under 1 or 2 years old worldwide, in my experience. Newer devices are also less likely to go wrong than older devices. So not only are you still covered by a warranty, you're less likely to have data loss or a broken device you need to pay to fix. The battery on your device should also still be fairly decent after 1 or 2 years, making the resale value higher and negating the need to pay to replace your battery, another expense, or have to put up with awful battery life, which can seriously affect your device enjoyment and productivity. If you buy lower-end gear more frequently, your net CPU benchmark and or power consumption is likely to be better, as current top-end CPUs aren't much more powerful than current bottom-end CPUs. Just look at benchmarks. Yet they do get much more powerful or much more power efficient with new CPU designs. You will also more frequently get the huge breakthroughs, like 4x battery life, retina screen, much faster storage, more RAM, and thinner and lighter designs, etc. Not to mention, you'll have the pleasure of owning shinier, newer, nicer gear that isn't falling apart. Once you take this and higher resale value of relatively new devices into account, this really should be not costing you much or even any more money to upgrade in 1 to 2 year cycles rather than 5 year cycles. You also made the point that it's better for the environment to keep using a device. Well, I'm certainly not advocating throwing a device away. In fact, if you sell it after 1 to 2 years, that ensures the device will continue to be used. You made the point that your Mac works flawlessly, so why upgrade? I'll give you two recent examples. Firstly, when I was living in Vietnam, I sold my 11-inch Air to my housemate for $500 and purchased a new one for $1,000. For this, I got double the storage and 4x the battery life. Those are huge wins. It meant I could work in new places without worrying about power, and I could have more productivity apps installed on my Mac, and more movies. Real benefits to my day-to-day life. More recently, I sold that, now 2-year-old Air, for $650. Over 2 years, it cost me less than 50 cents a day, and purchased a new 12-inch Retina MacBook for $1,600. Now, this was a bigger upgrade, but then the resale value will also be higher. For that, I got a Retina screen, double the RAM, and double the storage again. Thinner, lighter, fanless, faster storage, USB-C charging. Massive improvements to my computing life on the 2-year renewal cycle. If you were on a smaller budget, you could wait until the 12-inch gets cheaper or have just got another new Air. My point isn't really about pressuring people to needlessly upgrade. It's about leveraging the high resale value of Apple products in order to provide genuine benefits to your life from big technological advancements, and all without spending too much money net, or maybe even any more money net. Wait too long and the resale value of your machine will go down, warranties will end, batteries will wear out, and your device may need expensive repairs that you have to pay for. Apple gear is pretty unique in the tech world for having such high resale value. We should take advantage of that and be aware we can leverage it to get important upgrades without spending a fortune.
Hey, Nick, I really appreciate you sending in those thoughts in your own words, because I think it makes a lot more sense. You know, trying to convey it over Twitter in 140 characters or less back and forth makes it a little bit difficult. And I did my best on the last show to kind of, you know, convey your thoughts, but certainly hearing it directly from you is the best way to go, because I see the position that you're coming from. I see where you're coming from. And my point was, you know, not to say that you shouldn't upgrade every 2 years, or you shouldn't upgrade more frequently because you like to do so, or you see the direct benefits from that. My point was more in saying that there's also nothing wrong with going the other route and buying refurbished gear or using your equipment longer if that meets your needs. If you don't need a machine or don't feel you need to buy a new machine, you don't necessarily have to buy one. Now, you make some good cases and some good arguments for doing just that, but cash fluidity is a factor in this as well. It may be the case that I don't always have $1,000 extra available at that 2 year point or 3 year point to spend on that. But maybe I can sock a couple hundred dollars away at that point for a couple years later. And it may take me a little bit longer to save up the money to be able to buy my upgrade. And if that means that I have to spend, you know, $2,000 every 4 years instead of, you know, $1,000 or $1,500 every year, or every 2 years rather, then that might just be the way I have to go. So, you know, I have no issue with exactly what you're saying. I just think that the point is each person needs to make their buying choices and their technology choices based on what their own situation and needs are. And I do feel like there's sometimes pressure to have like the latest and greatest, and there's a cool status that we give to devices in our community, and sometimes people will look down on others for not having that, and there does become a kind of peer pressure that builds up, and people feel that, and again, I think that can lead them to making bad financial choices for them. And I just worry about that a little bit. So I'm saying not to do that, and that's one of the reasons why I spent some time, you know, talking about Apple's new iPhone payment plans and how they sort of can enable some people in some situations to make the wrong decision. So hopefully we're just thinking about these things and making really informed decisions. Again, you know, in my case, my 2011 MacBook Pro, as I mentioned, has served me for 5 years now. It's continuing to serve me. The battery life is still great. Plenty of RAM, great processor for what I need it to do. I did invest the money for an SSD upgrade, but I consider that money well spent, and I'm going to get many more years out of it. And I love the machine. I'm happy with it. So I personally am not going to upgrade, but I think that's just my choice. I can see your point about, well, maybe you want to try to sell that and spend a couple $1,000s or $1,500 and buy the latest and greatest thing. But I just really don't want to do that right now. I'd rather, at this point in my life, spend that money on something else. I'm looking into air conditioning because I work in this studio. I don't have air conditioning in my house, and it gets really hot in here in the summer. So that might be better well spent, at least right at this moment, for me. And that will delay my purchase of another machine. But I'm certainly not going to feel bad about having that be my choice, and I'm not going to feel upset about that. But then I think it's great if you can upgrade more frequently. Do that. Spend $1,000 on a new machine every 2 years is the same net result as spending $3,000 every 5 to 6 years, basically, as you pointed out. And it's really, six of one, half a dozen of the other. So again, I appreciate your feedback. I appreciate your comments, and thanks for chiming in on this. And then the last thing that I have to follow up on from last week, remember I said at the top of the show, this was going to be a lot of follow up from the prior week's show, was we talked a little bit about contacts and backing up contacts and contacts data, because, you know, I had somebody who had written in and said, I was syncing with iCloud, something happened, and I didn't suddenly have all my contacts data. And it worried me for a little bit, but I got the iCloud syncing issue figured out and it all came back. But at the same time, it made me think, you know, how do I back this stuff up? What if I lost it? Where could I get it? Where could I go to recover it? Well, Elliot wrote in this week based on that conversation about backing up and restoring contacts data, and he told me something that I did not know about iCloud.com. So if you're using iCloud.com or iCloud to sync your contacts, you're using it to sync your calendars, your reminders, or your bookmarks, you can actually go into iCloud.com and actually recover or restore some of your old or deleted data if something should happen. So to do this, all you do is you go to iCloud.com and you log into your account and then go into the settings area. And if you scroll all the way to the bottom, once you're inside settings, you'll see some links for restoring files, contacts, calendars and reminders, or your bookmarks. And you can click on one of those links. It'll bring up an interface, and it'll show you the history. Now, for files, what it'll show you is any files that were in iCloud documents in the cloud that you deleted within the past 30 days. And you have 30 days to go in and potentially recover those. So if you accidentally delete something and realize a couple days later, oh my gosh, I deleted that out of my files, you can go into iCloud.com and get at those things. So kind of an oops factor. And then for contacts, calendars, reminders, and bookmarks, there is past versions of those things. And when you're in there, make sure you read the warnings and instructions at the bottom of the panels, because it gives you some details about each one of the kinds of data and what happens when you restore it and things like that. But what's cool is, even if you make a mistake and say you restore some old data and that was some data that you didn't mean to restore, they actually have a process as well for reversing your restore. So not only can you restore it, you can also reverse a restore and go back. So potentially, I would imagine this would be a way to go back and selectively get some data. I'd be a little bit nervous about doing it, because it's a little bit scary to think, okay, I'm going to restore, you know, my data from 3 weeks ago, and then I'm going to revert it back. So I would recommend actually going a different route, and at the very least, making sure that you back up all of the existing context data before you try a restore. So use the process we talked about last week. But still, I didn't know that iCloud.com has a way to get historically at some of your backups or some of your data that's in there. I wouldn't technically call these backups. I wouldn't rely on them as backups. I'd still do my own backing up. But it's just another place, and it's an extra place where you might have some data that you can actually recover, and there's a process to do it. So thank you, Elliot, for sending in that tip. And then finally in the show for this week, Jason wrote in because he said he needs to install a library called FFmpeg. And this is a video library that has been around for a very long time. It's part of the Unix underpinnings of OS X, and different video applications and different video utilities sometimes rely on FFmpeg. As a matter of fact, I think VLC back in the day used to include the FFmpeg libraries as part of its package. It would actually install it for you. But Jason was looking to install it on his Mac. The problem is that FFmpeg and the libraries, they typically install through the command line, through some terminal commands. You actually have to download the source code, compile it yourself on your Mac. There's not just an installer that you can typically run out and get. And so one of the ways to make this a little bit easier to install these kinds of things like FFmpeg is to use what's called a package manager. And there's a very popular one called Homebrew. So Jason was looking into this and it recommended, hey, you should use Homebrew to actually download and install FFmpeg. And what he was writing in was he wanted me to talk a little bit about package managers and what they were. And secondarily, he wanted to find out, hey, is this really safe? You know, is this the way to go about this? Because we talk a lot about making sure when you're downloading applications, installing software, you install them from good known places. And so what is Homebrew? What does it do? And is it safe to use? So Homebrew is what's called a package manager for OS X, and it's basically a way to find, download, and install Unix tools and other open source applications on the Mac. And these things are typically called packages or bundles, and they're just source code that is distributed by the developers of the software that you can download and compile, meaning just making it run on your specific machine. Because there's so many variants of Unix and Linux and things like that, you can grab this source, you can compile it, and make sure that it's going to run and work on your machine. You're basically creating the software application from the source code yourself. And what the package manager does is it takes care of not only downloading all the files, but in a lot of cases, sometimes these packages will rely on other libraries and other packages being installed to be able to compile successfully and be built for your Mac. And so The package manager will also take care of downloading any of the dependencies and keeping track of it. And if new versions of the libraries and dependencies become available, the package manager can update those things, all that sort of stuff. So it handles a lot of the complexity so that you're not having to type a bunch of arcane, maybe obscure terminal commands. You certainly could do all of the individual steps yourself, but it takes a lot of the individual steps out of it. So a lot of people really like to use package managers. And so Homebrew is probably one of the most, if not the most popular one for Mac OS X. It is a command line tool, so it's something that you will run a command line. It will download and install itself on your Mac, and then you can use it from that point forward to get other pieces of software and packages and stuff like that. The other popular package manager for OS X is called MacPorts. Now, I am a Homebrew user. I think I've mentioned it, you know, several times on the show in the past for different things, and I do use it. But how does it actually work? What it does is it allows you to take a single command as input and then figure out, as I said, what software package you want installed. And then it downloads the source code of that package and then figures out any of those dependencies if they're needed and downloads them as well. And then it compiles or builds itself from the source code and dependencies and then installs itself. It builds the requested software and then installs it in a predefined or the predefined location for that application. A lot of times these library files go into a specific place. And what's nice about Homebrew is it installs the packages into their own directory and then provides what's called symlinks into the /user/local folder, which is a folder where you can install binaries and stuff like that at the Unix level. It's made available for users in OS X, and it's part of, you know, OS X's whole security system. And then if you want to get really technical and geeky, Homebrew itself under the hood uses Git, which is a version control system, and the programming language Ruby to actually do all of the stuff that it does. So you can actually build these Homebrew package installers and stuff like that using Ruby, some Ruby code, and put them into GitHub and all those sorts of things. So it's kind of maintained by the community. It's a whole open source thing. So that is what it is and what it does. And that brings us to kind of Jason's main question, though, is, and I think it's a really good one, is this stuff safe to use? Is it safe to use Homebrew? And I think, you know, there's many things to think about when you're using that word, is it safe? The Homebrew tool itself is safe in that it's good software. It's been around for a while. It's maintained. It's supported by a good community. The likelihood that there's anything malicious in there, at least intentionally, is nil, I would say. Being open source, there's always a chance that something might sneak in. But the advantage of open source is that the community kind of polices that stuff. They're on top of it. There's always people working on this platform. So, and the same sort of thing goes for any of the software that you might get via Homebrew. You know, it's about as safe as any other application you might get from outside the App Store, but there are a couple caveats. Since you're downloading and compiling and installing it locally from the source, you know, it's not monitored by Gatekeeper. It's not under the auspices of Gatekeeper, which is, you know, part of the OS X operating system that will check to make sure an application is signed by a developer or only came from the App Store. But that said, you know, you're running command line commands basically that are going to compile it and make it into an application. So as long as the source code is from a good known developer and a good source, an active project that's being worked on, something that hasn't been neglected, it's very unlikely you're going to get any malicious code in that package. And you're building it yourself from that source, so you kind of know what's going into it and what's coming out should be safe. And, it, you know, you also have the advantage that OS X's structure and permission system is going to minimize any kind of exposure. But, you know, could something sneak in there? Could it get in there? Yeah, potentially. But the risk is relatively low. You know, there's always, with any source code, be it open source or not, there's always a possibility that a vulnerability or exploit could sneak in. A lot of times when it's a commercial application, it's because they're using some sort of third-party library. And that's a very common thing for people to do. Recently, we talked about there was the ImageMagick exploit, which is a library for doing image manipulation on the web. And a lot of websites use it. A lot of software uses those libraries as well. So they potentially had an exposure point if they didn't upgrade to the latest version. But again, a homebrew for the dependencies, it has a way you can go through and you can run a brew update. You can update any of the packages that have been installed in any of their dependencies and make sure you're getting the latest and greatest code. And so the big advantage of, again, open source code is that you have a lot of people working on a project, looking at a project, as long, again, as it's an active big project. And something like FFmpeg, I mean, that's a big active project that's been around for a long, long time. It's going to be very hard for anybody to slip in or, you know, get any malicious code in there without somebody else in the community noticing it. And so you're kind of better protected from that standpoint. So I would say overall, relatively safe to use Homebrew. A lot of Mac users use it. I use it. I've never had a problem. And again, for active projects, well-known projects like FFmpeg, I think you're going to be perfectly safe. If it's some obscure little project and there's like one guy working on it and he hasn't updated it in, you know, 3 years, I would say, you know, that's a little bit of a problem. But the same goes for commercial software as well, right? Anything that you're downloading, you've got to look at who the developers are, who are these people, what are they doing, what does the software do? So you got to do a little bit of homework on your own. But, you know, I think you're going to be okay. And oftentimes, you know, you may be able to find an already compiled binary of a software installer for some packages. A big example of this is MySQL, a database. That you can actually get a binary from Oracle directly. And I typically just download the OS X native package installer from them, but I could install MySQL from the source via Homebrew as well. Either one of those methods would work. I just find it easier to get the binary. Now, I did a little bit of searching, and it turns out FFmpeg, somebody has built a binary for that, a binary installer. But again, I would feel almost safer installing it from Homebrew because I wasn't familiar with this developer. And now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with his binary at all, and he even points you to the source code that he compiled it from, but you are ultimately trusting the person that built that binary. And with Homebrew, you're building the binary yourself from source. So you kind of know a little bit better what's going on with that. But, you know, I think you're going to be okay using Homebrew. And hopefully I did a good job explaining what it is, how it works, and whether it's safe or not, Jason. So I guess the last thing I'll say in Homebrew is it really is kind of a more advanced level tool. So even if you're not comfortable, or definitely if you're not comfortable operating in the terminal, doing things at the command line, it's something you're probably going to want to avoid, or at least if you need something that, you know, you're doing some research and it says, hey, use Homebrew to install this, you know, get a little help. Because actually one of the areas of potential, you know, non-safety is typically with Homebrew, what you'll find is you'll land on someplace, it'll say, oh, install this with Homebrew. It'll just give you a one-line command to copy and paste into your terminal. You always want to know what that command is absolutely doing. If you're copying and pasting any commands into the terminal, you should know specifically what those commands do. And if you don't, you should look that up. Don't just trust some random website that's giving you some command line to run in the terminal, because the terminal is very powerful, and if you put the wrong command in, something can break. So you have to be careful when you're using it, but overall, relatively safe, and I think you're going to be okay. So thanks for that. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their software by going to smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other Apple products are worth over at gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, I welcome your emails and your audio comments. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That telephone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You're also welcome to leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype handle is the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you're on social media, the Twitters, the Google Pluses, the Facebooks, you can follow me there. Twitter.com/MacCast is the Twitter. Facebook.com/TheMacCast is the MacCast Community Facebook page. And over on Google Plus, you'll find us at google.com/plus, and that's the plus symbol, plus MacCast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.